This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. It's summertime, and that means it's a season for blockbuster movies. And with all the sequels and superhero films at the theater, it's easy to think that Hollywood has a formula that doesn't allow for much creativity. You know, protagonist wants something, overcomes the obstacle, and in the end either gets it or not. But film scholar Todd Berliner says Hollywood is more complex and creative than that. In his new book, Todd looks at the ways filmmakers have challenged the industry's standards, from classics like Citizen Kane to wacky sci-fi movies like Starship Troopers. The book is called Hollywood Aesthetic: Pleasure in American Cinema. Todd is also a film studies professor at UNC Wilmington and joins us now on the program from partner station WHQR in Wilmington. Hello, Todd.
Hi, Frank. It's a pleasure to be here.
A real pleasure to have you. Let's talk about the premise of this book, the idea that Hollywood is a little bit, even though it follows very closely types and can't afford to leave a successful format when it has it, you say there's a whole lot of creativity that goes into just making any old movie. That's particularly good.
Well, I wanted to write a book that understood Hollywood as an art form, because Hollywood is normally seen as a commercial enterprise. It's certainly seen as entertainment, but rarely have people looked at it, or I don't think ever anyone has looked at it systematically as an art form. People have studied individual Hollywood filmmakers or Hollywood movies, films of Frank Capra or Orson Welles or what have you. But what about Hollywood itself as an art form, in the way that we might study, you know, opera as an art form or Renaissance drama as an art form? And to make a Hollywood movie, you need artists. You can't do it without artists. So I wanted to look at it from that perspective.
And you use a number of topics in order to frame this discussion. The fact that Hollywood films offer aesthetic pleasure is one of those areas. So talk about how that fits with this idea that artists really do have to put all this together.
Well, aesthetic pleasure is something we associate with the arts. You can get aesthetic pleasure from nature or from, you know, other things, from a Harley Davidson or what have you. But it's something, the arts seem particularly well-suited to give us aesthetic pleasure. Aesthetic pleasure is, I mean, it's a contested area in philosophy, but aesthetic pleasure in the sort of broadest, most pluralistic sense is a pleasure that you get by experiencing the sensory properties of an artwork, but it's not purely sensory. It's not like the pleasure of ice cream, where your taste buds are excited, although it requires that sort of sensory experience. You have to experience the movie directly, immediately. It also involves some thought. It's not passive in the way that eating ice cream is a passive pleasure. And it also involves some appreciation of the work itself, some discrimination, some evaluation, some sensitive understanding of it. So my contention in the book is that the primary reason that people go to Hollywood movies is to experience aesthetic pleasure. Whatever other pleasures it offers, sexual, sensory, the pleasure of a social event, etc., are secondary, and that people go to Hollywood movies primarily because they want to experience aesthetic pleasure. And I think that helps us understand why people like some Hollywood movies more than others. I don't think those other explanations account for that.
Does Hollywood, is this a sort of an algorithm, though? Hollywood has now figured out how, one way or another, to offer that in a way that has become formulaic.
Exactly. I think that's a really good way to describe it. It's like an algorithm, a pretty broad algorithm, but it does have parameters. So Hollywood is making movies for mass audiences. That's its economic model. You can't make a Hollywood movie without appealing to a mass audience. The movies are just too expensive. But the fact that movies are designed for mass audiences doesn't mean that they're not artworks, right? You still have to use artistic principles. So Hollywood has figured out many formulas, many algorithms, in your phrase, that help deliver aesthetic pleasure to mass audiences. And I think that we can study those algorithms, or what I might call parameters, and then study what individual filmmakers have done within them that either enhance or challenge or expand or what have you, the aesthetic pleasures that the parameters offer sort of by their nature.
All right, well, let's talk about this. Writing is one of the art forms that is essential to filmmaking. And you talk about the way in which narration is handled dialogue being the principal way. And I would like to play a clip from the film His Girl Friday from 1940. To talk mm-hmm. about this, we'll listen to this snappy dialogue here as a way that advances the narration and come back and talk a little bit about it.
No, never mind the Chinese earthquake, for heaven's sake.
Billy, I just want to ask you one question.
Bruce, how did you get out of jail?
Well, not through any help
of
yours.
No, listen, buddy, you can't
come
in here. We're busy.
I had to wire Albany for $100 so I could get out on bail.
Look, I don't care if there's a million dead.
I don't know what they're going to think up there in Albany. They had to send the money to the police station.
Oh, for Pete's sake, Hildy, come on. We're waiting for that story.
We'll explain everything to them, Bruce.
Well, where's Mother? She said she was coming up here.
She left.
No, I can't hear you, Duffy.
Where'd she go?
Out someplace.
Don't know. Junk the Polish corridor.
Hildy, tell me where my mother was going.
She couldn't say.
There it is, a clip from the 1940 film His Girl Friday. I'm talking with Todd Berliner, whose new book is called Hollywood Aesthetic, Pleasure in American Cinema. I will say this, Todd, if we could talk as fast as they did in 1940s films, I could do the show in half an hour.
Yeah, that's true. And that's a particularly talky movie. I mean, some have described it as the fastest-paced, talkiest movie ever made. I wouldn't say that Hollywood primarily delivers narrative information by talking. It delivers narrative information in all sorts of ways. Movies have generally a wealth of ways to deliver narrative information. His Girl Friday emphasizes dialogue. But what I find interesting about the clip that you played, which I also talk about in the book, is how muddled it is with incidental information. The Chinese corridor, the rooster story, there's all sorts of things there that have nothing to do with driving the narrative forward and that clutter the scene but make it more exciting, make it more interesting, make it more disunified. And one of the things that I want to stress in Hollywood storytelling is that Hollywood offers essentially, two... You know, you could divide the way that narrative offers pleasure into two categories. One is the pleasure of unity, when everything comes together and everything fits and everything feels logical and correct. And that pleasure is the pleasure, say, of immediate understanding. We get cause and effect. We get clear storytelling. It gives us a kind of spontaneous pleasure, the pleasure of understanding something on contact. But disunity is the other kind of pleasure that Hollywood and other narrative art forms offer by way of their narrative. Disunity offers cognitive challenges. It stimulates our curiosity, our problem-solving activities. It creates moments of insight when information sort of pops into our head. That is a different kind of pleasure. That's the pleasure of mastering something challenging. And I think that clip that you played from His Girl Friday is an example of both those things. The narrative is being advanced in sort of incremental ways. We see Hildy's relationship to her husband and or to her fiance and to her ex-husband. But we also are having to weed through all of this disunified information, things that do not advance the story, but that make it more exciting and interesting and that cause us to sort of try to master what's going on in the story. And a filmmaker like Howard Hawks and actors like the ones in those clips, Cary Grant and Rosalind Russell and Ralph Bellamy, are experts at delivering that information in a way that is both clear, unified, so that we can immediately understand it, but also that clutter that scene with all sorts of incidental information that put furniture between us and our desire to understand what the narrative is doing.
And you say that, in a sense, Hollywood's not given enough credit for understanding and being able to deliver that kind of thing, not only just a kind of a pleasant riddle, how do I sort through all of this dialogue to follow the stream that's going to advance the narrative, but other deeper challenges that might take us into, deeper intellectual inquiry using tropes and aesthetic devices that seem very, just plain old pleasant, and escape, for instance.
Yes, and I think that balance that Hollywood has to strike, on the one hand, because it's a mass art form, it has to be clear, right? I mean, that's just a design feature of mass art. You cannot make mass art that is not fundamentally clear to the audience. You can do it with avant-garde art, but you can't do it if you're trying to appeal to a mass audience. And I don't see that as a failing of Hollywood cinema. That's just a parameter. It's an economic parameter of the art form. But on the other hand, if things are too clear, too logical, right, too unified, people get bored. And so you have to offer them something moderately challenging, something that's not going to jeopardize their understanding, not going to interfere with that spontaneous pleasure of understanding something on contact, but that nonetheless offers something that is going to spark their imaginations, spark their problem-solving activities spark their curiosity, and that means there has to be something challenging in it.
You write in your book, Hollywood filmmakers negotiate conflicting pressures for familiarity and novelty.
That's right. And if something is too familiar, we're bored. You can watch The Godfather and love it, but eventually you're going to get tired of it. You say, show me something new that's going to stimulate my mind because I've mastered The Godfather. So Hollywood has to create variation, novelty, as indicated in the quote you read from my book, and it has to create complexity because people just get bored if something is too simple. But it can't do it in such a way that's going to alienate a mass audience.
And nowhere is this skill better illustrated, perhaps, than in the film Groundhog Day, when the conceit is that we're going to be repeating the same scene over and over again. And so how are we going to make this sustain for 90 minutes? But let's play a clip just to refresh our memories. Groundhog Day.
Do you ever have deja vu, Mrs. Lancaster?
I don't think so, but I could check with the kitchen.
No, that's okay. Thank you.
Will you be checking out today, Mr. Connors?
I'd say the chance of departure is 80%. 75-80. Excuse me. Where's everybody going?
To Gobbler's Knob. It's Groundhog Day.
It's still just once a year, isn't it?
That's from the 1993 film Groundhog Day. I'm talking with film scholar Todd Berliner, whose new book is called Hollywood Aesthetic, Pleasure in American Cinema. So there's a pretty good illustration of a successful film that did the impossible, kept repeating the same scene.
Yeah, and so the trick with Groundhog Day, I mean, I think the aesthetic challenge for the filmmakers was that they had to create, they were going to have a repetitive scenario. The same set of scenes over and over again. And how do you make that interesting? Well, you vary them. It's a kind of butterfly effect movie where if you change this one thing, what's going to change? And I think one of the things we're doing when we're watching that movie is we're thinking we're projecting a hypothesis. How will that change play out in the future? And we're making these comparisons. Oh, there's that guy, but this time he's passing him by, he's not talking to him, etc. And so those slight variations with interesting twists and butterfly effects create part of the challenge of the movie, where we think we need to compare what we're seeing now to what we saw before and we're projecting into the future. How will this affect things? Is he going to get out of this day if he does this or that?
Hollywood has also been able to, given its long history, been able to trade on itself and overturn some of the types and tropes that it's created. So talk about that in terms of ideologies, taking what you think you're going to see in this film, whether it's a genre or a film about a particular ideology, and how Hollywood has managed to masquerade a film in the sense of something that was familiar and then overturn your sense of what you're going to see.
Well, because Hollywood, again, is a mass art, it's not going to be a source of new ideas. Or rarely is it going to be a source of new ideas. There's the occasional movie with a truly subversive ideology, right? A movie, you know, maybe Bullworth would be an example, or The To-Do List, or Amadeus. There are these examples of Hollywood movies that are really presenting ideas that are not commonplace. But mass art forms generally deal in commonplaces. And so when Hollywood uses ideology, people have complained, scholars have complained, that Hollywood is essentially an instrument of ideology. It's of dominant ideology. It sees its duty as to perpetuate existing beliefs. I look at it somewhat differently. Even though I think that that's true, Hollywood fundamentally is not going to be a source of new ideologies. Hollywood isn't an instrument of ideology. Hollywood uses an ideology as an instrument for delivering aesthetic pleasure. So if you have an ideology, you know, Hollywood doesn't care whether you buy guns, for instance, or whether you're violent or not. But if it adopts a ideology of violence, then you get to have exciting scenes of violence when your hero uses violence in order to defeat criminals or other bad people, like you get in, say, Die Hard or Independence Day or et cetera. And those movies have strategically eliminated any possibility that the protagonist could have a recourse other than violence in order to solve whatever urgent problem they're dealing with. That's not because Hollywood likes to promote violence. It's because violence is a way that Hollywood gets to create exciting scenes.
Right. But you can use it to either glorify violence and whatever ideologies go with it, or to subvert the idea of violence. But in either case, you get to show the gory pictures, and that's why I went to the movie.
Yeah, exactly. And sometimes Hollywood gets to have it both ways. It gets to both have the violence and then condemn it. Mm. And then you get a number of movies so that would be the sort of simplistic use of ideology and the typical use of ideology in a Hollywood movie in order to sort of concentrate your emotions, concentrate your thoughts so that a scene, you sort of long for release in the form of violence or maybe in form of some other kind of release, but always based on some dominant belief, hard work, leads to success, or true love will eventually come your way, or other commonplaces. But then you get movies that are also somewhat disorganized or dissonant in their ideologies. So I'm thinking of movies like film noir or Starship Troopers or The Dark Knight or The Last Temptation of Christ or Invasion of the Body Snatchers. These are movies that seem in conflict with themselves ideologically. And that also becomes interesting because these movies become objects of curiosity. You can't master them.
Well, I've got about a minute and a half left, and we can't have this conversation without talking about Star Wars and the fact that its critical and popular reception were very different when it first came out. Tell us what that tells us about the industry.
Yeah, so one of the many interesting things about Star Wars is that scholars hated it when it came out. Generally, it got generally a poor reception among film scholars, but of course, the culture loved it and still does. And I think the takeaway from that is not what people might think. It's not that scholars sort of just disdain popular success, though maybe they do, or maybe we do. I don't know. I think that scholars had so much experience with the tropes that were being used in that movie that they found it simplistic. They could identify those genre properties, say, too easily, whereas mass audiences who have only moderate familiarity with film history found the movie complicated. And I think, and I was 13 when I first saw it, I thought it was complicated. Now I'm a film scholar. I can identify all the properties and I find it, relatively easy to master. But it was combining in a fairly, I don't know if sophisticated is the right word, but certainly in a diverse way, elements of the swashbuckler and fairy tales and adventure films and the Western and science fiction serial and fantasy comics and samurai movies and, the comic duo in the form of C-3PO and R2-D2 and the philosophical fantasy film like Lost Horizon, horror, gangster, right? War movies, Nazi documentaries, historical epics, science fiction, obviously, film and television. And it was combining all these ways in a way that felt just inevitable. Like it seemed, of course, these things are going to combine. And film scholars see that and they say, oh, it's just culling things from the culture. Yeah. But if you're a novice film goer or an average film goer, it's exciting because there's so much there to master.
Right. And it's cobbled together in a sophisticated way that holds up as a story, whereas otherwise it might be a confusing mishmash.
That's right. Hutchison, the philosopher, called that uniformity amidst variety. And that's why you get a figure like Han Solo, who mixes the pirate from an Errol Flynn swashbuckler and the hero of a Western. And when he's matched with Princess Leia, one half of a screwball comedy pair in a way that feels absolutely inevitable. And yet we had never seen it before.
Todd, fascinating stuff. Wish we had more time. Todd Berliner, his new book is called Hollywood Aesthetic, Pleasure in American Cinema. Thanks so much for talking with us, Todd.
Thank you, Frank.
Todd is also a film studies professor at UNC Wilmington and joined us from partner station WHQR in Wilmington. Just ahead, we're going to talk with a North Carolina filmmaker about his career in the movie industry when he saw a very early version of Star Wars. Stay tuned.